Tonight at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain, Frontline and ProPublica bring you Terror in Europe. It's a joint investigation examining unprecedented vulnerability in Europe to terrorism attacks, from the slaughter at the offices of satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo to the attacks in Brussels in March of this year. Correspondent Sebastian Rotella examines the looming threat of terrorism in European countries as authorities sound the warning of systemic failures and security lapses. Sebastian Rotella is an award-winning foreign correspondent and investigative reporter. He joins us now via phone from Washington, D.C. Sebastian Rotella, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with this notion of unprecedented vulnerability. Tell me why it's unprecedented.
Well, it's unprecedented in the sense that this wave of radicalization and of terrorist activity is unprecedented. What the jihad in Syria did in 2012 was take a threat that always existed in Europe, but that was manageable even with the structural problems we talked about in the defenses, and just this eruption of people, thousands of people going and joining the jihad in Syria, and thousands more radicalizing in Europe because of the Islamic State, in particular, their very successful brand of propaganda. And what that did was overwhelm the defenses and expose some of these structural problems we talk about in the film in Europe, which are that as good as some of the counterterror agencies are in places like France, and they are very good, there's a series of problems. For example, border control. For years, security chiefs in Europe have been talking to me about that Europe has a real problem with borders because Europe's internal borders are open, so everybody relies on the external border controls, but that's pretty much left to the individual countries, which vary greatly in their ability to protect borders just in terms of resources and capability. So it's not unlike, you know, a small state in the U.S., say Arizona or Arkansas, being said, well, you handle border control without the help of the federal government, because in the European Union there is no equivalent. So that's one. Or the whole problem of databases of intelligence sharing, which are still very difficult because these are all different nations within the same entity. And the terrorist groups have taken full advantage of that. And in this terror campaign of the past couple of years, that's why you see people, most of whom were known terrorists, many of whom were on watch lists and even had arrest warrants, moving back and forth across Europe, going back and forth to Syria as they were preparing these attacks and being, you know, stopped, questioned, even arrested, but somehow managing to slip through and do these attacks anyway.
Tell me how history has impacted the philosophy and the data sharing challenges that we're looking at today. Some of those countries are more concerned with data sharing than others.
That's right. In other words, you have great differences between the way different countries view privacy and security, and there's not an overarching legislation the way there is in the U.S. that would unify or harmonize that among states, say. So you don't have the equivalent of a database that everyone in Europe can look at, or everybody in Europe uses the same way to put in terrorists, because, for example, privacy laws in Scandinavia are much more intense in terms of putting somebody. You can have someone identify as an extremist in your country, but the law is much more rigorous in terms of telling other countries that you suspect them of being an extremist. There's another very fundamental challenge in the U.S. since 9/11. One of the things we did to improve our border defenses was start using something called passenger name record, which is you know, considered a very basic tool for security, which is that the Department of Homeland Security gets access 72 hours in advance to information on passengers coming to the United States, and uses that. It's basically just the information that you give to the airlines, addresses, phone numbers, emails, travel histories, things like that, but uses that to screen and look for people who might have terrorist connections or are coming from dangerous places in the world, and it's a real advantage. Europe doesn't have that, and that it has been proposed repeatedly because Europe, in a way, is a lot closer to a lot of dangerous places where terrorism is prevalent. But in the European Parliament, a small group of legislators who feel that privacy is absolutely, you know, this is an absolute invasion of privacy, this thing that the U.S. has been using for 15 years, have blocked it. And there's a number of cases that we look at in the film that if this PNR screening, this advanced airline screening, had existed, it's more possible, if not probable, that certain terrorists would have been detected and perhaps the attacks stopped. So these are all the kinds of things that Europe is, after this you know, year and a half campaign of terror, is dealing with now the way we did after the 9/11 attacks.
Let's talk a little bit about recruitment of young people and how that was different, the shift that you talk about in the film between how Al-Qaeda was recruiting people and how ISIS was recruiting people. It's a very stark difference in of how those young people are kind of coming out of boredom, out of almost like a trend. Explain that to me.
Exactly. I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda was different. Al-Qaeda, first of all, the numbers were smaller. It was harder to join Al-Qaeda. People who joined Al-Qaeda, not in any way to defend them, but usually knew more the way political radicals tend to know more about their cause. They knew more about Islam. It was a longer process. Going to those camps, the training camps, you know, you had dozens of people going, not thousands. And so it was just more selective and smaller and slower. What has happened with the Islamic State, with the Islamic State has this hyper-violent, very slick bombardment of propaganda showing all this brutality, which has attracted a lot of people. And the Islamic State has had a much different attitude towards people who go to join the Islamic State often had very little primitive, you know, had primitive knowledge of Islam. Hmm. To the extent that you had people showing up in Syria and posing with AK-47s, and several investigators say to us in the film, these were people who weren't even radicalized, right? So what does that mean if somebody's willing to join the most radical Islamic group and they're not radicalized? What happened is the Islamic State has had this appeal almost the way an international gang would, you know, to a lot of people who really were involved in crime. You see a lot more people in crime going into extremism now because of the Islamic State and the lines between crime and extremism blurring, and people becoming terrorists in places like Belgium, some of the people we look at who kind of had more gangster lifestyles, you know, wearing flashy clothes and going to casinos, and didn't really change that much when they became terrorists, which makes it even harder to spot. So that's one of the reasons the numbers are so big. The security forces have so much trouble monitoring people, both because of the number and sort of the way this radicalization manifests itself. And it's been one of the, you know, as I said, one of the things that's just kind of overwhelmed the defenses in some of these countries, not all of them, particularly the ones with second and third generation Muslims who are the most prone to radicalization, like France and Belgium.
I don't think I'm the only one who struggles with, but this embracing of a culture of such extreme violence, and there's some footage in the film that sort of elaborates or demonstrates very clearly that mentality, that the more extreme violence is just so accepted. Can you articulate for me how that's even possible when you watch this?
Why that appeals to people, you mean?
Yeah, what is... It seems like such a monumentally naive question, Sebastian, but
the
violence,
it's
a
question that a decent human being asks, right? Yeah. When you see that stuff. Let me put it to you this way. I mean, Al-Qaeda had, when you look at the bin Laden documents and communications that have been recovered, Al-Qaeda, not to defend Al-Qaeda in any way, but had certain limits, right, to its propaganda, whether it really believed you could go too far or whether it thought it was bad propaganda, but they were like, we shouldn't show, particularly if it involved killing other Muslims, right? We shouldn't show this. We shouldn't use this in propaganda. It goes too far. Mm-hmm. The Islamic State is the opposite, right? There's no limit to the kind of barbarity it does and which it shows. But they have tapped this whole pool of people who are apparently attracted by that. People, I think, a higher percentage of people who are crazy, who are violent, as I was saying earlier, for whom the religion and the politics of it are really just a veneer. And those people went rushing off to join that. I mean, one of the cops I talked to the most, who's also in the film, has described it, a Belgian counterterror official, Alain Grignard. He talks about it being a real live video game, you know, a certain culture that has been brought up in these tough neighborhoods where, you know, in certain tough neighborhoods in Europe, there are just a few things going on the street, and one of them is this gangster mentality. And ISIS kind of plugged into that, so it's like becoming the ultimate gangster is joining ISIS. And I think that partly explains what's going on, that you plunge into Syria and all of a sudden you're living in this hyper-violent fantasy video game.
Hmm. How difficult is it to get it right, to get the intelligence right, to get the counterterrorism right? How hard is it to be successful?
It's hard. I mean, what's interesting is, again, it's kind of a contradictory picture, because we certainly show that the security forces were quite successful in identifying people and having a sense of what was going on, but there were certain things working against them. One is, as I was saying to you earlier, this problem with borders, this problem with databases, this problem with the lack of coordination and intelligence sharing. Another, which we look at particularly in the case of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, the attacks on the magazine, the satirical magazine that had printed the caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad in January of 2015, most of the people involved in that case, and this is true, by the way, of a number of leaders and people who have popped up in other cases and other attacks, most of the people in the Charlie Hebdo case were people who had not only were known as radicals, but who had actually been convicted of terrorism and spent time in prison for terrorism. They had, in the mid-2000s, been involved in going to Iraq to fight. But unfortunately, the way the system is set up, if you can't prove that someone has killed someone, say, when they go off to join al-Qaeda in Iraq, pretty much in France they would charge them with conspiracy for terrorism, and they would get 10 years at the most. And most of these guys got 3 years, 5 years, 6 years. And so they were back on the street, had only gotten worse in prison, and back. And there's a lot of people now like that who are coming back onto the street from having done time for terrorism, and that's a whole population that, security chiefs in Europe will tell you with great frustration, in the United States they would have gone away for 15 years, they'd still be in prison, we wouldn't have to worry about them. So that's another thing, in terms of these structural problems that Europe is wrestling with now. How do you start to fix problems like that?
There are many people who sit down with you in this documentary to talk about some of those failures, to talk about what they knew and didn't act on, to talk about what they knew and did act on, and the limitations. You can see the weight of their failure on their faces, in their body language. You can see as they explain things what it was like to hear about an attack and then realize that you maybe could have done something different. What was your experience sitting down with folks and saying, we maybe got that wrong?
These are people I've known for a long time, most of them, and I've had these conversations with them a lot. So I think it was maybe, there was a certain bond or connection where it was easier to talk to me about it in some cases. And in others, I think, because what they were talking about, yes, they were taking some personal responsibility, but they were also rightly saying, this is something that goes beyond me or any other individual. This is a structure, and these are problems I have been, and people like me at the top of the intelligence and security services, have been publicly expressing concern about to the political leadership of our country or of Europe for years, and there was nothing done. Right. So I think there was a sense, that we have, let's explain that this is not something that happened out of nowhere and that we didn't know about and we didn't warn about or try and do something about. So I think there was a cathartic sense, because, I was talking to these people, some of them, the day after they had led big terror operations, or soon after the Brussels attack. So they had been working, for months. And they were telling me, we have seen this one veteran, Belgian cop, he says, my young colleagues in counterterrorism have seen more violence in 2 years and have worked harder and been more overwhelmed and more demoralized and had more public scrutiny than I have in 30 years. This period has been so extraordinary that I think there was, there's a real sense to want to talk about it. And it was, it's really something to have seen how much of a strain it was on these people, because
Sebastian,
they do great work and they're very talented, and really feel it, take it very personally.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.